Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 34. What if you spent 4 years in solitary confinement?
It was a very simple world in a way. God was sort of in charge, and you know, you had to fight communism. Mom was sort of a Democrat, sort of a Midwest sort of Democrat, and Dad was kind of an Eisenhower Republican. And he was in the Air Force. He was an officer in the Air Force on bombers, jet bombers, and that kind of thing. We would always argue. So my dad was in the Air Force, and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they would have to get into planes on alert, just sort of hovering in various places, probably had targets. And he said at one time, he says, well, the Russians don't want to bomb us because they know there is a retaliation. So what he was talking about, of course, was, you know, deterrence. I knew that there was something not quite right about it. At 18 years old, I was for the Vietnam War. This would have been 1969, or 68 rather. Well, I finally went to college, and I started meeting people who actually read books. I came to understand that there was a kind of a consistent life ethic, especially when it came to executing criminals. So I came about this by way of the death penalty, because if you killed this person, that ended their capacity to reflect anymore on what they did wrong. Then I began to look at, well, also in war, that life, you've taken that life, they cease to be able to reflect anymore on what their life is about and all that. And of course, many people were forced into war. I began to see that life itself offers us all these beautiful chances to come around and change and do good. Before you know it, within a year of getting into college, I was applying for conscientious objector status. My draft board didn't even know its own rules. Draft board didn't even know how to handle someone applying for conscientious objection. So they turned me down right away. Oh, you're not a conscientious objector. And not only that, but we're going to draft you pretty soon. So it was an uphill battle. As it turned out, they had what was known as sort of a lottery for the draft, and I won one of the only lotteries I've ever won. I came up with, like, I don't know whether it was 14 or 17 or something like that. What was lit up in me was my conscience. I was not going to take another person's life, period. You have to picture that half of California was either refusing or not showing up. So I was one among a lot of people. Then I later on get in the mail, you're now, I think it was called 1H, and I looked it up, this is no longer available for military service. I think they took the high-profile people and prosecuted them. You know, the U.S. attorneys probably had stacks and stacks of people to prosecute on their desks, you know, files on their desk. Small potatoes. That's what I was, small potatoes. But it changed my life. By 1968, something that really changed my opinion was the draft file burnings of the Berrigan brothers and others in what was known as Catonsville. They actually went into a draft board, threw the files into some metal baskets, went out into the parking lot and burned the draft files. So they were good role models for me as well as, you know, for being a Catholic and taking a look around as to what is conscientious objection all about for a church that's not traditionally anti-war. I was working in the meantime, in my summers, working for disadvantaged and handicapped people. But then as I got closer and closer to working out my, let's call it my religious vocation, I was going to join this Mary Knoll organization, which was responsible for publishing liberation theology. Now this was a whole different sea change in terms of how theology was done in the church. One bishop in Latin America, Dom Helder Camara, put it very well. When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask, why are there so many hungry people, then they call me a communist. And so this, I sort of picked up on that and, you know, tried to carry that a little bit further. And Then in 1980, this is after I'd been through college and I had been with Mary Knoll for a time, I had met Daniel Berrigan and Sister Anne Montgomery. Didn't know what they were up to. But in 1980, they did what was called the plowshares, the first plowshares, a King of Prussia plant. And they went into this factory that makes these and hammered, poured their blood on them and hammered on them, 8 people, to embody the prophetic vision of conversion, swords to plowshares. That's how it got its nickname, the movement. And then the more and more I was immersed in my formation as a Jesuit, I was sent to Africa, for instance, the Sudan. I was in the Sudan during civil war and famine. But the Sudanese army and the rebels all had these nice M16s. And so anyone who had a gun was eating. I noticed this, and it affected me very, very deeply. And I said, this is really a part of it here. See, is it only the violent are going to eat, or is it only the violent are going to survive? And then I noticed that the people in Africa were saying unilaterally, without me soliciting it from them, saying, you know, it's your nukes. You know, you've got the whole world divided up according to, you know, the power structure. Why cramming these geopolitics, shoving it into a local area? I felt, okay, I've been released. I see where the violence is coming from. The violence is coming from here. I don't need to go to every country in the world. I don't have to go too far to find that this is the place where I, you know, have to do the struggle. So it was lit up in me. For a long time, the first traditional step in ending nuclear weapons was to stop testing. My life-changing experience came in 1982. Went to what was known as the Lenten Desert Experience. And it took place near the Nevada test site, out in the middle of the desert. What happened to me is I crossed the line for the first time. I risked arrest. If you had been talking to me before then, you would have said to me, Steve, well, how do you feel about nukes? I said, they're wrong, they're awful, but you know what? They're probably here to stay. There's too many wealthy people making money off of them. After crossing that line, hope was born in me, and this has made all the difference in the world. Hope. For the first time, I experienced real hope. Jesus was stepping between the danger and the flock. The wolf and the thief really are dangers. In today's world, the thief is the larceny of the budget, the Pentagon budget. It's stealing. It's a larceny from the poor. So he'd come between the danger. And the wolf, of course, is the possibility of the nuclear weapons being used, is that would be the complete annihilation. He wasn't this saccharine image of like, okay, let's just keep the flock together. I'm a really nice guy. That's why they killed me, by the way. That's why they crucified me. I'm a really nice guy. No, he was defending his flock, if you want to use that metaphor. I was finally ready in 1995 to say, you know, there's Lockheed Martin. They just merged. They've become the largest manufacturer of weaponry. So myself and Susan Crane on the West Coast and some people on the East Coast at Newport News Shipyard entered these plants where they're making these weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, and did our plowshares on the 50th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So Susan and I hopped the fence at Lockheed. And as we were approaching, we were all very concerned about how to get into the building. It was such a joke. It was like God's little joke to us, as we had just worried and worried and worried. With these huge bay doors as big as that wall opened up in front of us, and we just simply walked right in. A person came up to us and says, oh, if you're coming in here, you've got to have on safety goggles. And that person went and get safety goggles, and we were just like, we just kept going. And we finally found in production the missiles. They look like huge wine vats. They were rings of the 45-foot missile, the Trident. And so we poured our blood on them and hammered on them and knelt down and prayed after putting out pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims. And there was all this noise going on, and as we started hammering, this guy that was working next to me, what are you guys doing? He says, we mean you no harm, just call security. So we were pounding on the side of it, and then all of a sudden the place got like super quiet. And we knelt down, and the pictures are all around us, and there's blood poured all over the side of the, you know, the missile casing. And we just knelt down and really quiet, and security came along, and man, what are you people doing? What is this? Where did you get these badges? We had made fake badges and all this kind of stuff. And then this one guy walked up to me and says, man, I don't know what you guys are all about, man, but you sure got guts, you know? Wow. And I think we kind of had the picture, you know, that the employees didn't really want, they would rather have a job where they were making something that really benefits humankind. But here they were making the D-5 missile for the Trident submarine. So the cops eventually came, arrested us, took us off to jail, and then our court battle. So much ink has been spilled over these plowshares cases in court. You have to defend yourself against either a trespassing charge or a government property destruction charge. The nukes are not on trial here, and yet it's our duty to put the nukes on trial before our fellow citizens. You can't talk about nukes, you can't talk about U.S. policy, et cetera, et cetera. And yet international law is very clear that the nukes cannot be justified. That's our second action. Sure, we went into a plant at Lockheed Martin and addressed the nuclear weapons themselves. But what I think is a more dangerous room of the Pentagon are these courtrooms that are saying the nukes are legal. And a nuclear war, therefore, will be legal. Juries have had to be sent out of the room as we've turned our back on judges and this kind of thing, because the judge has made a ruling in favor of the nukes. The first one was a year, and then he wanted us to do supervised release afterwards. I refused. Okay, yeah, there's a warrant for my arrest. I have to avoid a lot of places because they can't, you know, a lot of friends and stuff like that, because if they give me any help, then they could be charged with aiding and abetting a fugitive, right? So I was back east, and we prepared for another plowshares, which we did in Maine. So my second plowshares got 2 years with an additional 14 months added on to it. And then finally, then we did another action against depleted uranium. So we did that action. And then finally, after about a 7.5-year hiatus, we got together in the Northwest and entered the nuclear arsenal called SWIFPAC. It's probably the largest amassing of nuclear warheads anywhere in the world. So we entered there in November 2009, the five of us. We walked in and cut through the fences. So it looked like a prison. They had guard towers and all lit up with lights, and then two sets of concertina barbed wire fences, and we clipped through those. And all of us spilled into them. And then we're met by the Marines who guard the place after we'd cut through the inner fence. So they contained us and they handcuffed us, and we laid on the ground for 4 hours on the cold, wet grass. 4 hours interrogation, you know, two of them at the same time talking and trying to get information. So at first it was a misdemeanor trespass, then it turned into, when they started adding up the damage, about 9 months later we were told we were being prosecuted for property destruction and all that. Felonies, a couple felonies. March 2011, the five of us were sentenced, various sentences. I got 15 months, Susan got 15 months. And then, like I say, I refused to give them my address, refused to tell them where I was going. So they said, well, you have to appear in 3 days at the probation office. I said, oh, I'm not doing it. The third action is jail resistance. I don't go to jail to be in jail. It's not my goal. I'm not going to jail to be. It's just the consequences of what I think are very good actions, very good witnesses. But it is a struggle to humanize yourself. The guards are somewhat, you know, it's a job for them, and after a while you get dehumanized. They dehumanize themselves in the process. So it's a struggle to be human. So I refuse to work, because the feds say you have to work, so I'm saying I'm not going to be a part of it. And usually it's to help maintain the prison. So I refuse work. Then I refuse drug testing. Usually, especially the urinating and all that, it has to be done. A guard has to watch you. A CO has to watch you urinate. Well, that's degrading for the guard, too. Then there's the breathalyzer. So that's my opportunity to refuse drug testing, alcohol testing, to work, and to not program. So they have no alternative. The only coercion they can put is to throw me into the hole, which is solitary confinement. It's the jail within the prison. So that's usually where I've spent half of my time. So I've been in prison for over 90 months total, when you add it all up. About half of that's been in solitary. Like, they come at you with this, Kelly, you got to do a breathalyzer. I said, no, I don't have to do a breathalyzer. As a matter of fact, I'm here against nuclear weapons. I'm not here to do this. They said, you have to do this, Kelly. I said, no, I don't have to do this. So it goes on and on until they finally, wait a minute, let me get this right. You're saying, because you're here against nuclear weapons and you consider yourself a political prisoner, and therefore you're not taking this breathalyzer? I said, well, you pretty much got it. That's right. Yeah. And they go, well, Kelly, you are, you're some kind of nut or something. And then of course the prisoners also hear about it. But they all of a sudden say, oh, Kelly's here against nuclear weapons. So it catches on where it wouldn't have before. And then I lose commissary, I lose good time, I lose phone privileges, I lose visiting privileges, it all goes. And I end up doing the maximum time. And yet, you know what I have, though, is my conscience is with me on it. Solitary is interesting. I make like a monk. And you know what? There's not enough time in the day. I have so much to do, either between writing seriously things or writing letters, responding to letters. Then there's sleeping and eating and praying and exercising. I do yoga in the morning. Then there's serious reading or something, some nonfiction type stuff. And then Phil Berrigan, when we were together in prison, taught me, you got to read your pulp. You got to feed your imagination. I don't mean trash, but pulp. So you spend a couple hours doing that. There really is not enough time in the day. People are really writing about their concern and all that. Then I write them back, and I'd be spending time with you, in a way, at least in my imagination, which was provoked. And it is an alone experience, but then I've got my prayer and my spiritualities, and with God, I don't feel alone. Somebody sent me once the Hobbit and the trilogy, the Ring trilogy. Man, I could feel my imagination working, just going. The Lord of the Rings, reading it. Just if you've got some kind of, let's say, an inner life, you're all of a sudden radically introduced to the internal life and what's going on. There's a whole universe of things happening. And then it's also a time for prayer. You and God can, kind of sort of alone with the alone. If you can imagine, go into your bathroom, because it's about the same size, maybe 7 by 11. Go into your bathroom where the tub is. That would be where your bunk is, tub and the shower, and you have one sink and a toilet. And then the only people you're interacting with are people who can't call you by your first name and are not supposed to, by the rules, are not supposed to be friendly with you. So that goes on. And then once a week, the suits all come around with a warden. Well, Kelly, you're still here? Yeah. You could be doing a lot of good outside. Yeah, well, yes, I hear what you're saying, but I feel like I'm doing good here. So it just goes on and on like that. And no human being could be too satisfied with that socially, but the human being is very resilient and very adaptive. So the warden came along and she was funny. She'd go, well, you must like it here, Kelly. Well, I mean, are you faulting me for adapting to the place? No. And they said, we're just not getting to this guy, They only have one thing they know is coercion, and that's the federal government, too. They only know coercion, and once their coercion that's up, well, there's nothing left for them to do. So I don't want to say like I'm real, cozy with the guards, because that's not really it. But I have to empathize, and that's part of my humanity. I have to empathize with them, And sometimes I just have to simply take a stand. Kelly, you're making it hard on us here. Why are you making it so tough on us? I said, this is the way it's set up. I'm not inflicting this on you. This is the way it's set up. I could say maybe I had a sort of a midlife crisis, in my mid-50s, I guess I could probably say. So I said, well, now, what's the best thing to do with my life? And I kind of came to the conclusion the plowshare still remains the best thing I can be doing. I may look foolish in the eyes of the world, but I have my solace. Because there's a war of words out there. But what really makes a difference is behavior, no matter who you are, right? After a while, I think I would feel pretty empty if it was just a lot of talk. Here's Gandhi. Here's his first comment when he hears about Hiroshima. He says, "What will happen to the soul of the nation that used such a device?" Isn't that interesting? He was so relational in what he was doing, and it's so, what would you call it, engaging of his opponents, that he saw, he says, "What will happen to the soul of the nation that used such a device?" And look what's happened to us. Our very imagination is captive. And why are we like under siege, and why do we see everyone out there trying to get us? Well, mostly because of the aggression. So the imagination has taken over. The imagination would be the very thing that you would use to find a way out of it. But if your imagination is captive, you just see knee-jerk recourse to violence. I'm not going to keep lights on at the Pentagon or something like that, or the White House. I'm trying to wake up the faithful, the people who already believe that you can't kill in this way, this indiscriminate way. People already believe that, but they have to be reminded of it. Martin Luther King says, when evil is going on, that's awful, and that's bad, but when good people collude with it, then you've really got a problem. Jesus came to affirm life, not to annihilate it, you know. So my thing is to wake up that sleeping giant.